ladies and gentlemen, welcome to an actual podcast. I'm Robert. I'm driving. I do these things around here that I start with the word from, where I'm from the stands or from the field or from the what? This is from the highway, which is me driving Indianapolis to Champaign and recording some words and answering your questions while I'm just sitting here by myself in the car in a little thing we like to call from the highway. Here's the story. My wife was, she travels for work. She had a flight to Dallas out of Champaign that's 3 hours delayed, which means she wouldn't make her connection, which means she wouldn't make her 8 a.m. meeting. And the only option was a quick drive to Indianapolis to get on a plane from there to Dallas and then the connection, so she can make her meeting tomorrow. And she couldn't really drive the car and leave it at the Indianapolis airport because she's flying home to Champaign tomorrow night. So that means best option was me drive her over real quick to get on a plane in Indy. And I now have 2 hours, about an hour 45 home. So I figured, you know, I haven't done this forever. I haven't had a long drive solo in forever. So why not up from the highway, right? Right? Right. So, I put the call out on Twitter and on our Slack channel, where our subscribers exist in a little thing off to the side. And I will now read some of those questions as I drive I-74 and answer them until I get back to Champaign. So, you know, right to it, right? All right. In the call I put out, I restricted questions to four categories. Those four categories are Illini football, Illini basketball, Illini golf, or my high school tennis career. And the very first question is from, responded on Twitter, from my high school health class teacher, the person who taught me about the reproductive system, ladies and gentlemen, has asked me a question, which I'm obligated to answer here, which will not make sense to anyone. But the question is, Will Brown or Scott Plocker? Okay, so here we go. So those are two kids I played tennis with in high school. They were older than me, both were 2 years older than me. So I guess this question is, who would win a match between Will Brown and Scott Plocker? I mean, I'm obligated to answer here, so I'm going to give the answer. So Scott Plocker was the older cousin of my friend Jeff, who I played tennis with all through, like, growing up. He and I would go up and play tennis together at Spindler Park, and then Jeff and I were on the tennis team together. Scott was his cousin, 2 years older. Will, or Wuba, as we called him. Wuba, I think, was also my sister's age, 2 years older. Yeah. So, like, when I was a freshman on the tennis team, they were juniors. And then most of that whole class graduated after this. I think there were four guys on the tennis team. So basically my turn on varsity was then junior and senior year. So by the time I was playing varsity tennis, Scott and Will had just graduated. They basically vacated their spots and that slid me in. If Wuba, we're playing. Side story, when my office moved from one business park to another business park in St. Louis. The guy running the moving company who showed up to give a quote on how much it would be to move it happened to be Will Brown. That's the end of my story. Let's see. I'm going Scott Blocker. Like Jeff, he was just consistent. High school tennis is the guys who can hit really good shots but make a lot of mistakes versus the guys who just won't make a mistake and send everything back and frustrate you until you make a mistake. And Will was the first one. Scott was the second one, and I think Scott wins that match. So question number one is now answered with Scott Blocker. Yes, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, I haven't done a podcast episode in months. And to start off with me just randomly talking about two guys on my high school tennis team that were my sister's age, we're going for the awards. We're going for all of the awards. Okay. Let me change lanes here. One of those cars. It's like an 18-year-old kid. Go to the cars that, you know, they pull up next to you, but then they just go your speed. I call them magnets. Like, they don't really have a speed on the highway. They just have whoever they're next to. So they're going along at a good clip, faster than you. You're waiting for them to pass you. They get next to you, and they stick to the side of your car because they haven't thought about their speed in hours. They're too busy texting their friends. Okay. Let me see if so while we're on the tennis theme, let me see if there's another tennis. Oh, there's another tennis question. Okay, here we go. What was your record senior year? Oh, God. People. You're not ready. What was your record senior year? Doubles, singles. What did you feel is the strongest part of your game? Do you still play? Do you play pickleball? Strap in, okay? Just get ready. Get ready. So here's the thing. Scott Blocker, Will Brown, and that whole class graduates. My junior year, the tennis team, I grew up in Highland, Illinois, so this is Highland High School in the Metro East, Madison County, 29 miles from the St. Louis Arch. Junior year, we had no seniors, okay? So, junior year, it was three juniors. That would be my friend Jeff, my friend Bill, and I. And three sophomores named Kevin, Mike, and Jason. Or Jay, as we called him. Okay? That was the tennis team for both junior and senior year. So, you know, there were no seniors on our 1990 team. And so then in 1991, it was the same guys, just Jeff, Bill, and I were seniors, and Kevin, Mike, and Jay were juniors. Okay. This is Highland High. We are a Mississippi Valley Conference. So back then, the Mississippi Valley was O'Fallon, Highland, Wood River, Roxana. Okay, Wood River and Roxana is where the Shell oil facility is. I mean, Roxana is literally the Shells. And, you know, it's like the first sponsored high school team in the world because their helmets are the Shell logo. But, I mean, they're supposed to be just the Shells, but they're Shell because every kid's dad worked at the Shell oil plant in Roxana. I'm getting off. So Jerseyville, way out, an hour from Highland. So Jerseyville, that's Jersey Community High School. It's basically all of Jersey County, north of Alton. Belleville Civic Memorial. I'm sorry, Bethalto Civic Memorial. My gosh. Somebody, whoever went to CM, just when I said Belleville Civic Memorial, freaked out. Just absolutely freaked out. So Jerseyville, Roxana, Wood River, CM, Civic Memorial in Bethalto, Illinois. Troy Triad. If you follow high school baseball this year, Champaign Central just lost the Triad on Monday with a berth in the Final Four at stake. Highland, and then O'Fallon. Oh, and Muscoota. Sorry, I forgot Muscoota. Muscoota is down by Scott Air Force Base. Every Muscoota program just had brand new kit. The football team, it was always changing because, you know, people at Scott Air Force Base would have 4 years or 2 years, and then their time is up. They go to a different base, and those kids move away with their families, and the whole team is different next year. So that's what Muscoota's always dealt with. Since then, there have been changes. O'Fallon got too big for the Mississippi Valley Conference. Roxana Wood River got too small. You know, Waterloo came in. O'Fallon went out. Like, there's a whole bunch of changes. But that's who we're talking about, okay? So we're talking high school tennis, Metro East, 1990 and 1991. My game was doubles. My game was only doubles. My ability to just blow a singles match was not even close. Like, I was the sixth man, right? All right? So you have six guys on the tennis team. You were either playing matches of nine matches or seven. So you're either winning, like, you know, you win 9-0, you win 7-0, or you win 4-3, you could win 5-2. Or if it's a nine, you could win 5-4. So you'd play three doubles matches, and then in some, you would play only four singles matches. In others, you would play six singles matches. It just varied match to match, tournament to tournament, conference, this and that. And so as the number six guy and on number three doubles, there was often matches that were only seven where Bill and I would play our third doubles match against the third doubles team from wherever else. And then we would sit, and it's just Kevin, Jeff, Mike, and Jay playing singles because we're 5-6. Sometimes, you know, like, you know, especially a lot of out of conference, we go play Vandalia. There's six singles matches, so I'd play a singles match. But often I'm just playing doubles, right? Okay. So me and Bill playing doubles. Still see Bill at Festivus every year. Our friends celebrate Festivus. Just saw him on December 23rd this past year. So, my game was really pretty much catered to doubles because I could volley and I could serve, but my ground stroke game just couldn't hold up against anyone. I just couldn't get into, you know, hitting it back and forth 15 times, kind of a rally. I'm going to make a mistake. I'm going to hit it long. I'm going to hit it in the net. I'm not a ground stroke guy. I could return serve. I could serve. I could volley. But yeah, I'm a hot mess when it comes to singles. So yes, there were several matches we won. Like, we had a pretty good team. We would win 8-1. Sweep doubles, win 5 of the 6 singles matches. With a loss down there at the six singles, old Rosenthal didn't pull it out in three sets, lost in a third set tiebreaker to Hillsboro. But here's the other thing. When you have a pretty good team and you play third doubles, and Bill had a really good serve, so we were a pretty good doubles team, you can win a lot because you're playing the third best doubles team from every team. You're often playing sophomores and freshmen. You know, if you're just playing a seven match, if there's just four singles, three doubles, the other coaches on the other teams are often using their two freshmen, get their feet wet with some doubles. And so, you know, Bill and I are juniors and seniors, and we could serve and this and that. And so we'd win our third doubles easily. As a result, folks, are you ready? Are you sitting down? After our senior year, we got at like the sports banquet, our coach made us these little plaques. My little plaque, which I have. I could find it somewhere in a box. I had the highest winning percentage in Highland High School history. mostly because Bill and I went, like, you know, 25-2 in doubles matches every year or whatever we would do. You know, we'd lose in sectionals and this and that. But when we're just playing third doubles against somebody's freshman, we're winning that, right? So that's my claim to fame. I had a really good record, even singles end up, because I'm playing number six, right? I'm playing the crappy, the certified worst player on every team. You want to feel like you're good at something? Be sixth singles, third doubles on a high school tennis team. And you're like, pretty good at this. I wasn't very good at this. But, you know, look, the plaque says highest winning percentage in Highland High School history. And I'm going to just stick by that because nobody really knows. That just means I played the sixth best singles player and the third best doubles team on every high school team. So, I'm just going to keep going here, folks. Again, you asked the question. I'm just driving. I got nothing else to do. My claim to fame is that I went to state. I think I've shared this story before. I'm pretty sure I've shared this story. I went to state as a junior in 1990. I could tell my grandkids, and I do have grandkids now, that I played in the state tennis tournament, that we qualified for state. There's a photo. Every team at Highland that qualifies for state, baseball, softball, track, whatever, you get a photo on the gym wall. There's a photo with my fat head on the gym wall. As an athlete, there's a photo of me as an athlete on the wall of the high school gym to this day. I have a photo of it somewhere on my phone. But let me tell you, and this is how I tell the story every time, I was, and this is fact, not opinion, the single worst player at the state tournament. And here's how I can say that that's fact. 1990 was the last year that teams qualified and not individuals or individual doubles partners qualified. If you finished in the top four at districts or sectionals, and you finished in top four, like the four finalists in the bracket, or the top two teams back then, you went to state. Belleville East won the sectional that year, but we finished second. And by finishing second, we went to state. Now, if those of you from Chicago, you might know that the North Shore high schools, your New Trier's, your Palatine Frems, no, that's not really North Shore. The tennis players all in the state, like the top tennis players in the state, 9 of the 10 would have come from north suburbs high schools where the parents have had the kids with private tennis lessons since they were 7 at the country club. So, there's just no match for downstate tennis to when you're up against the Chicago suburbs. I mean, you think it's a mismatch in other sports. There's two classes. There's 1A and 2A basically in tennis. And like we were big enough high school to be 2A. And so we're just matched up with the best. And so there were, I believe, 8 sectionals. 2 teams from each sectional, and then the top 4 doubles and singles from each sectional would qualify for state. And we finished second in the Southern Illinois sectional, which was by far, without question, the worst sectional. So, 2 teams make it, we were second place. 6 players on a tennis team, I was number 6. Worst sectional, we made it to state as the second best team. I was certifiably the single worst player to play in the state tennis tournament. Look, you asked the question. I'm just going to keep going. We get to state. We're staying at some hotel. I think Hersey in Arlington Heights was the main high school, but then you would get your court assignment and you would go off to like play at some other high school's courts. Like they couldn't hold them all at the same place. I think Hersey was the main spot. Anyway, somewhere Arlington Heights or somewhere we had our hotel room and we are playing basketball because this, it had like a health club and a gym attached to it. I can't remember where this was, but we decided to play basketball and my doubles partner, Bill, rolls his ankle, like black and blue, severe high ankle sprain playing basketball. Real smart of us. We have to go to the emergency room. He's on crutches. He's basically out. We call this guy Randy, who was on the tennis team, because they said we could sub in, but we didn't have any subs there in Chicago. So for me to play my match the next day, Randy had to, like his parents had to drive him to Chicago. So, that night, I come down with strep throat. So I have this really high fever. I'm in the hotel room. I'm like, finally at like 1 a.m. or 1:30, I go get my coach. And I'm like, hey, coach, can you drive me to the emergency room? Like, I feel like crap. So we go, they diagnose me with strep. They say, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, you're not playing either in the state tennis tournament tomorrow. You know, we got to get this fever down. They give me these pills. And they give me some antibiotics. The antibiotics on the jar clearly say take with food. I don't take them with food. I just take them and go back to sleep. I wake up puking at like 4 a.m. Go knock on my coach's door because my parents aren't there. I'm 17 years old, 16 maybe. Like, I don't know what to do. Like, we just go knock on the coach's door. Like, coach, what do I do? Go wake him up again. He drives me back to the hospital. They're like, yeah, this isn't the sickness. This is just you took your antibiotics without food and it made you puke. So, coach takes me back. We go. We get up. 8 a.m. Our first match is like 10 a.m. I'm in the room with Bill. Jeff comes in and he's like, guys, I know Randy's on his way, but you have to do this. Like, you need to be able to tell people you played at state. Even if you don't play well, you're going to want to do this. So we go to the place. Like, at the hospital, I had a 103.6 fever or something like that. I'm sick as a dog. But we go. We meet with the trainer. Trainer meets with Bill. They see his black and blue ankle. This is, I guess it was 2 days later at this point from his ankle, rolling his ankle. And he's like, can you tape it up and I play? And the trainer's like, yeah, I mean, if you, like, it's just a sprained ankle. Like, you're, it's just whether you can walk on it. So they're taping up Bill's left ankle. They're giving me some, I think I took some kind of, I don't know, ibuprofen or something, just trying to get my fever down. And I'm not telling them that I was diagnosed with strep. Like, I'm just, like, faking it. I'm like, oh, I just don't feel good, you know, this and that. But they're like, all right, you guys are good to go. So we play. We play the number 6 seed in the entire state, Homewood Flossmoor number 1 doubles team. We go to warm up. I know I've told this story before. We go to warm up. We are warming up. Bill's hitting tennis balls on this ankle for the first time. He's like, I think I can hit forehands, backhands. I can volley. I can move a little bit. I can hobble. But I can't serve. Like, I just can't put all my weight on my left foot and then twist to serve. It's just too painful. So Bill, okay, you ready for this? Okay, just picture this. Bill at a mullet, okay? Bill at a flowing, gorgeous, beautiful, curly haired mullet. This is 1990, June, May of 1990. I had some floppy hair, really, really bad haircut. I put gel in it. It's like spiked the one side. Just don't ask. So we, in our uniforms, like, we're clearly from Southern Illinois. Okay. We are clearly from Southern Illinois, playing these two kids from Homewood Flossmoor. We're warming up by ourselves, then we have to go warm up with these guys. Bill can't serve. So Bill has to serve underhand. Picture you're this Homewood Flossmoor team. You're playing these guys from Southern Illinois. Clearly aren't good. You're going to beat them. You just know it during warm-ups. Like, all right, don't expend too much energy. We got another match this afternoon. And you're playing a guy who is serving underhand, like a underhand free throw kind of thing. He's like bouncing it and like dink. I regret to inform you, we lost 6-love, 6-love. We did not win a single game. Either set. We went to the loser's bracket, where we did make a little noise. We won the second set in a tie break. But in the loser's bracket, we did lose that one in the third set. And that afternoon. And then I laid in bed for 2 days. And Bill was on crutches for a week. And Randy got there and was like, "You guys made me come all the way over here, and then you decided to just play?" And we're like, yeah, blame Jeff. He came in our room this morning and talked us into it. So that is high school tennis for me. Like, there could be no other questions, because I have answered everything about my high school tennis career. The worst player to play at state, maybe ever. The debate is out there. The worst player to play at state lost 6-0, 6-0 to Homewood Flossmoor. But my photo is on the wall in the gym. As an athlete, ladies and gentlemen, the tennis story. Oh my gosh, I'm 27 minutes in. God bless you if you're still listening. Just God bless you, everyone. Okay, I'm digging through. I'm going through for more questions. I better go to Slack. I don't want to miss Slack questions. These are the subscribers paying me directly. Okay. More important, portal ad, backup punter, or kickoff specialist? I'm going to say backup punter. That's pretty clear to me. We know Crimmins was pretty good at Purdue last year, so we know he can do it. But we don't know that we know that. Like, David Alano, we know, will be the kicker. We're pretty sure Keelan Carmins is going to be the punter. But it could be somebody else. We might, you know, he might have the shanks. We might. So the Texas State kid, Rao, is probably the more important. And he's only a second-year player. So he could, Lars Rao could become our punter, you know, after Crimmins graduates, or even before if he beats him out. So I'm going backup punter. Any plans for a 17-club tailgate at Duke? You know what? This offers me an opportunity. I will take that opportunity. So I don't talk about that stuff much. We have 3 different tiers. We have an introductory membership at Illini Boards, $25 a year for the first year. You get to see what we're about. You get to read every article, this and that. And the main tier, the base tier, is what we call a Grange membership, $77. Gives you every article, but you also get the newsletter. You get the previews that I write, the big long preview for football, and then the preview Tyler and I and Ben write for basketball. And you get some other stuff, like the Slack channel, where these people are asking the questions. It's kind of our private message board of just Grange tier subscribers. And then there's also 17 Club. 17 Club is $17 a month. You don't really get much more other than some secret stuff, like get-togethers like that. And I always feel bad talking about it. Like I'm talking, like you're going to feel like you're not turtly enough for the Turtle Club. Like, it is a thing, and these are real supporters who pay me $17 per month just to, like, support me. And so I try to make myself available to them with tailgates and, you know, happy hours at Big Ten tournament and things like that. But I always feel weird talking about it, like, especially on Slack, because it's not all 17 club members on Slack. So it always feels like this neener thing of like, ha-ha, there's a secret club and you don't get to be part of it. But, I mean, look, I should talk about it. You know, that would be probably part of the sales of it is like, hey, there is this club where you get more access to the stuff and tailgates and things like this. But for some reason, I just feel weird even talking about it on Slack because it's like, not all of you are 17 club. So this is just super secret. Here's the secret. Everybody lean in and I'm going to whisper. But that's just me because I'm stupid. Yes, I think we're going to do a 17 club tailgate thing. Like what we did at Oregon last year. We're going to try and do one of those at Duke this year. So if you're 17 club, you'll get an email about it. And you'll also get an email about a Engine 77 tailgate this fall that will be open to 17 club. And I just, let me take this opportunity. All of you in 17 club, thank you. You're the supporters. You're the ones who make this happen. So God bless you. Thank you. Okay, let's just finish out all the other questions here on Slack. Okay, football question. How do you think game day atmosphere will be this different this fall for home games with higher expectations? That's a great question. I saw a photo the other day of the Michigan game. And I also saw one of the, like, I think there were drone shots of the, was it the Kansas game when the drone was in the air and they were getting all those cool shots of, like, what a full stadium looked like? I think it was a Kansas game. Anyway, those games were dreams for me. They still exist in this space of, like, I can't believe this place is so full. Not just every seat is sold, but just the, you know, so many rows with someone in every seat. An Illinois football game has always been about, look, you can sit with your friends if you want. There's going to be four seats in front, six behind, that those people aren't using those seats. Even if they're sold, not everybody goes, you know. So, yes. And I made note during those games that, like, we kind of do need crowd lessons. Like, when to get noisy and, like, there was one time Altmaier's waving his hands down, like, hey, can we be quiet? This is a big third down play kind of thing. And people were, like, all excited about what was about to happen. Like, we do need lessons because we haven't seen good football for a long time. And we just don't know how as a crowd to, like, hey, get loud here and get quiet there and that type of thing. So I don't think I think it'll be a while before we have a great home atmosphere, like, compared to the other Big Ten schools. Compared to what Illinois has been, we are night and day better right now. Compared to the last 30 years of Wisconsin fans knowing when to make noise and when to, you know, we're just not going to be there yet. Now, the focus of this question here is, like, you know, is it different with higher expectations? And I do think so. Like, there were boos in the past at Illinois games. Just because it's the knee-jerk standard thing, we suck. So if one slight little thing goes wrong, here we go again, boo. The boos this year would be different because in the same way that we don't know what we're doing yet as fans, we probably don't know how to handle 9-win expectations as a fan base during a game. Like, Michigan State went to the playoff in, what, 15, 16 or whatever, and they won the Big Ten a couple times, and they built up their expectations as a team. But Michigan State, even during those years, would have they beat Eastern Michigan 34-27, and they barely survived Purdue at home when they turned it over three times. So I think there is a thing where our fan base doesn't doesn't know that when Iowa goes 9-3 every freaking year, they still barely beat Northern Iowa 22-21 by blocking a field goal in the final seconds. Right? Like, people just expect, oh, safe and easy wins over every team, and then it's tied at home with Maryland with 6 minutes left, and people are like, what is this crap? I thought we were supposed to be a tough... Look, it's college football, and it's going to have its ups and downs, and we're not going to be Ohio State or Oregon blowing people out and then playing three close games. We are going to be what Iowa and Wisconsin and Michigan State and what those other teams have done while building it up. You don't have the high-end talent of a Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, you know, add Oregon to that. And because of that, there are going to be close games. And because of that, the way we play football, it's going to be 9-7 at halftime, and people will be upset. But it's still the path for us to get to 9-win seasons, which is the thing we've always been dreaming about. So, yes, I don't expect us to have the... I expect us, and I'm including myself in this, as a fan base, not knowing how to react to expectations, especially during a game, especially, you know, you start out giving up a kickoff return for a touchdown and people not going to their, oh God, here we go again space. We got some baggage. It's going to take us some time. Patience, everyone, because this is all we've ever wanted. Another Slack question. Where's your favorite spot on campus? Okay, every time I hear an on-campus question, I think of, like, campus and not, like, bro, I lived at C.O. Daniels. Like, this would be, like, university, like, on campus. And I think I'm going to have to restrict myself from the athletic department or athletic facilities, because I would so easily just say, you know, if I'm up on the, if I were on the roof of the Memorial Stadium tower above all the suites and club seats, looking down over the stadium I consider to be the most beautiful in the world, of course I'm going to pick that, because, you know, that's what I love. But let me eliminate athletics and think about this from a student from my years on campus. Where did I mean, I'm fighting this answer, but it just is. Standing in front of Follinger looking at the entire quad. You know, the little echo spot there in front of Follinger where you can stand on the circle and speak and hear your voice bounce back to you because it's a perfect circle with the concrete piers there, pillars, and I just that view of the Union and the sidewalks and the trees. If I'm taking somebody to home campus, oh, there's no question I'm taking them there. I have favorite little spots of where I would go, and, like, you know, I have favorite moments of campus of, like, the convenience store at, like, Nevada and what is that, Goodwin there, in what runs in front of Krannert, anyway, just south of Krannert, there's that little convenience store where when I was in my landscape architecture studio, I just go by there at 2:30 in the morning and get a snack and some more caffeine or whatever, and, like, that, just walking into that store could fill me with every emotion from campus. But, yes, if there's one spot, it's south end of the quad, standing in front of Follinger, looking at three blocks of grass and wondering how the hell I ever earned a degree from this place. Okay, I think that covers... Does that cover... Let me refresh Slack for a moment. Yes, that covers what was in Slack. So we'll go back to the questions... on Twitter. Oh, there's nobody out here on the highway. I thought there'd be more people on, like, a, what is it, 5:15 p.m. Central, so 6:15 Eastern on a Wednesday. I thought there'd be at least some traffic on 74. Anyway, okay, here we go. Okay, I already answered that one. Okay, here we go. At what point would the football program have arrived? The point where it's not just a good few years or a couple special classes, but we can start to feel like we have expectations every year, and one bad year is just a blip rather than a reset. Basically, when are we the new Iowa? Okay, fair. To clarify, there's a second one here. To clarify, I'm asking for what markers or milestones you'd be looking for to identify this, not a prediction for when it actually happens. Okay, good clarifier here. Okay. Obviously, the first thought is something I've just said forever. We have to have two solid seasons in a row. We had two winning seasons in a row in 2010 and 2011. But the second one of those was go 4-0 in the non-conference, beat a terrible Northwestern team and a terrible Indiana team, and that's your 6-6 and go to a bowl when you lose the other six Big Ten games. It's back-to-back winning seasons because we won the Kraft-Fried Hunger Bowl after Zook got fired, but those aren't two back-to-back good seasons. It's why I wanted to win that Northwestern game so bad in 23, because we could put it to bed. We would have had winning seasons. We could have had winning seasons 22, 23, 24, and then we're off. I guess this is, I'm going to violate your, I don't mean when do you think it's going to happen, little clarifier here when I say this, but like 2026, right? Let's just face the facts. The Big Ten schedule gets harder. We play both Duke and Missouri in the non-conference. So we have 11 games against power conference teams. And on top of that, we will probably start 14 seniors this fall. And so we will be bottom 10% in returning production. We will have a new quarterback and a lot of everything else in 2026. I'm prepared for that. I'm prepared for that to be this current recruiting class is so good. I could see them playing a lot of those guys as true freshmen to get them ready quickly in 2026. But I think we all know it's a step back. I think we all know that we're not at some point of Iowa is just going to win, you know, 8 or 9 games every year. Like, it's a lot easier to hold that off, especially when you have, you know, the transfer portal and you have now 105 roster spots and you can go into the transfer portal and get a lot of people. And look, Kurt Cignetti turned Indiana into a playoff team in 1 year by bringing 15 of his James Madison players and a whole bunch of other transfers. So it's a lot different than it used to be. But look, Barry Alvarez rebuilt Wisconsin, they went to the Rose Bowl, and then they had a 4-win season after everybody graduated. And then slowly built back up to where they could maintain it every year and get at least 7, 8, 9 wins. You know, Kirk Ferentz at Iowa had, I think he was really good in years 4, 5, and 6. And then it was something like 7, 8, 9, they won 6, 5, and 6 games or something like that. there's just these cycles and you got to build it back up. Easier to do now, but I'm not of enough of a fool to know that 2026 is going to be like 2023, where we're throwing a whole bunch of new starters out there and it's going to take some time before we are rolling again. So I guess my answer is the marker to me is still back-to-back winning seasons, not the two Big Ten wins and four and six pointless wins over six bad teams. You know, yes, we beat Arizona State in 2011, but they ended up not even going to a bowl. Yes, they were ranked at the time, but they failed, and we exposed them. That was not like this past year where we're beating South Carolina and we're beating Nebraska when they were ranked, and we beat the Michigan team that beat Alabama and, you know, hung with Penn State, everything else. 2011 was nothing like this past season. So I'm gonna still say the marker is back-to-back solid seasons where we see that we don't have that. Everybody graduates, and then we got to build it back up again. It's just ready to roll. So I'm ready to see that 27 and 28. Look, if we have a bowl season in 26, it's over. Like, everything you're asking in this question is accomplished. We're there. We've arrived. It's done. But I still think it's with the schedule and with, you know, basically 80% new starters. I think there's going to be a blip again next year, and that's fine. It's fine. It just means we're not fully built to where we need to be. Look, Alvarez had that 4-win season in year 5 or 6 or whatever, and then rolled from there forward. And I expect Illinois to roll after 26 forward, but still could be a blip in 26, and that's not a good thing. We're slowing down for a construction zone, so I don't want to go to the phone just yet as traffic is merging into one lane. We don't want to be that guy flipping through the phone when we're here. So we're talking, we're sharing things. Oh, this is just one of those down to one lane for a few seconds because the bridge is being redone and then back to two lanes. Okay, this is easy. All right, how deep are we in here? 48 minutes about? Okay, that's pretty good. I still got, 45 minutes of driving left? Something like that? Go an hour and a half? That works. Okay, back to questions. Favorite Memorial Stadium post-game win song? 1999, My Way, Sir Duke, or something else? I think this is asking, like, which should we play, or, like, what do I like that we standardly play, because we do play My Way a lot. But reading this question, my brain immediately goes to us playing Sweet Home Chicago when we beat Northwestern in 2011. Nathan Shielhouse scored on a sneak with, like, 10 seconds left, and we beat Northwestern, and we all celebrated. Northwestern had just debuted their Chicago's Big Ten team thing or whatever, and so we decided to play Sweet Home Chicago over the speakers as they walked off the field, and I was a huge, huge fan. So I don't know if that gets to the tenor of what you were asking, but that's the answer I have for that question. Next question. What do you want to see done with the south end zone? What's your ideal renovation plan? This one will be a long answer. The thing people, I think most people do maybe understand it, but they're still confused about, is the original idea for the Smith Center. What is the Smith Center now? The football performance facility. The original idea was to put it underneath the south end zone. That it would be one project where we add all those facilities, everything we added in that facility there, the team meeting rooms, the coaches' offices, the training rooms, the training tables, the nutrition areas, the weight room, all that stuff that's in that football facility would have gone underneath the stands there on Kirby. And we would have moved the stands in to where, you know, the 40 yards or so of turf from the back of the end zone to the front of the stands where the track used to be would have been eliminated. Those seats would then be right on the back of the end zone and underneath and above. You know, the coach's office would have been at the very top of those stands with balconies off of every coach's office looking down on the stadium. You've seen these renderings before. That was the plan. Lovey came aboard. I know they toured facilities. I know the Texas A&M facility was kind of the marker for, hey, we like that. And the idea was, look, if the new home locker room is in the stadium, okay, so if they would have built the original design for the Smith Center, which was under the south end zone. Hope I didn't say north end zone earlier. Under the south end zone, under the horseshoe. If they would have built that in 2016 or 2017, whenever they started the construction on the actual Smith Center, if it had been there, then the locker room would have, there would have been a new tunnel. The team would have come out from there. So, you know, opening of the game or even at halftime, team is headed to a tunnel there under the horseshoe. That's how it would have been. All the locker rooms, everything would have been under there. The point that Lovey's staff made at the time was, look, we practice in the indoor a lot, and we practice on those fields out there along 4th Street a lot. And if my players are getting taped up and ready in the stadium, then they've got to go up the stairs of the stadium and out and across just to get to practice every day. Doesn't it make more sense to have a long journey from the locker room to the field on game day, but then for every practice, you're either going out to the football field in the stadium or the fields or the indoor, and everything's right there, you know, basically trading a locker room that's close to that to a locker room that's close to this. That decision was made then to attach the football performance facility to the Irwin Indoor instead of attaching it to the stadium. And that effectively killed the renovation project for the horseshoe. Put it all on hold. So that's the main answer here is, like, people act like it was put on hold and like, when are we going to be a big boy program? And we proposed that in 2013. It's 2025. A dozen years later, we haven't done anything with it. Well, the reason we haven't done anything with it is because we changed it. We separated it and made it two projects. This is where I say I wrote at the time, and I still maintain it should have been in the south end zone. It should have been under the horseshoe. I wish we would have stuck to the original design and put it there instead of putting it attached to the Irwin Indoor up the hill and across the street. But it's done. Nothing we can do about that. But that means that there's another project to be done, which is, hey, those crowds aren't very close. The front row of the horseshoe is 30-some yards. I think it's like 39 yards or something like that from the field of play. And there is a project to be done that wraps the stadium in, that expands the horseshoe. Maybe you do some of those things underneath still, not what it would have been for the Smith Center, but maybe you still do some offices or suites or whatever you do. We've seen a lot of teams do this. They want a practice facility, so they expand their end zone. They do new kinds of seating or club areas or even patios and this and that, and then they have their football facilities underneath all of that, and it's one construction project for two needs. So what do I want to see for the south end zone? What am I hoping to see? the number one thing needs to be, we don't need all that turf between the horseshoe seats and the end zone. We need to get the fans closer to the field. We need a more intimidating environment. We need the fans more right on top of the stadium. And so we need to redo the end zone. From when the decision was made in 2016 or whatever to build it as a standalone to today, there has not been a single moment, and I mean this, there's not a single moment when it's been necessary. And I mean that even in a, you got to look ahead and you got to build, you know, for what you want to be. You got to dress for the part, you dress for the job you want to have, not for the job, you know. I don't, even in those, like, let's invest in and hope that we're going to rebuild the program, and when the program's rebuilt, the renovations are there. There hasn't been a single moment between 2016 and 2024, let's say, where it was in any way necessary. In that time, we had one sellout at the beginning of 2016 and didn't sell out another game until Kansas last year. Okay? So, expand the horseshoe. Ask for donations for Illinois football to do hundreds of millions of dollars of renovations to the stadium. Build out more seats, more concessions, more everything when we can and fill the stadium as it was. There's been no need for it. However, might have heard that we just capped season tickets and are only going to sell the rest of the games as single game seats, which means we'll sell at least 4 games and possibly all 7 this fall. So let's combine these last two questions, right? Like, when do we arrive? When are we there? When are we Iowa and can expect at least 7-8 wins every year and sometimes 9-10? When we get to that point, then that's when we're going to need this stadium. And if people put as much as they did into the reseat, then we're starting to get to the point of having the donors necessary to do a stadium project like that. So ask me this 8 months ago, and I'm still in, like, guys, let's maybe sell out a game first. And now my eyebrows raised. I'm thinking about it. I'm curious. I'm paying attention. Maybe by 2030 it needs to be done. Maybe it's time. And yes, my preference for that whole thing is, I would like to see seats as close to the stadium as possible. That means at least 2 sections in East Main and West Main will kind of be demolished, because that's where you have to start the curve. Right now the curve starts beyond the end zone, beyond the back of the end zone. The curve of the horseshoe starts, and that's why you have all that grass there. This needs to be something wedged in there with seats all the way down to the field level, and then as far back as you could go to Kirby, and to have a wall there. I'm for the first time thinking I might see that in my lifetime. Because before, it felt like something that was 20 years off. Okay, we're in an hour. I need to make sure I am getting to everyone's question. So, how important is it for us to have another Isaiah Williams on the team? Okay, so now I'm curious. Is this saying we need to get another Isaiah Williams on the team? Or is it saying Nasir Rankin is Isaiah Williams 2.0, and how important it is for us to have him on the team? I think it's B. I think it's about Rankin. So I'll just say it's wildly important, and this one has an Illinois driver's license instead of a Missouri driver's license. So we got Isaiah Williams because we hired Corey Patterson. And that's why he crossed the river. That's why he didn't go to Ohio State, didn't go to Alabama. That's why he stuck and stayed with Illinois, because we hired Patterson. And Rankin is an Illinois kid. So the top kid in the city of Chicago picks Illinois, and that's very, very, very important. ABI isn't dead. ABI is anywhere but Illinois. It's the disease we have been fighting for 30, 40, 50 years. That kids in Chicago, it's cool to not go to Illinois. Like, I don't know where I'm going to go to college, but I just know it's not going to be Illinois. We've been fighting ABI, and it's still a thing, and it's not going to fully go away, but a guy like Rankin puts a huge dent into ABI. So, yeah, it's, I feel about Rankin the way I felt about Isaiah. You know, like, it's, you just don't get athletes like this. It's going to be great to be able to utilize an athlete like he is. I don't know exactly where or how, but look, that guy's gone to Notre Dame or Michigan my whole life. So having him in Champaign is going to be fantastic. Why does the Duke game terrify me more than Ohio State this football season? I mean, that's it. That's so easy. It's so easy. Well, hell, I'll just list it. Went on the road in September of 23 to Indiana and lost. Went on the road to Kansas and lost. Same year. Went on the road to Virginia in September of 2021 and lost. Went on the road to UConn, I believe 2-10 UConn team in 2019 with our bowl team, and we won, I believe, 30-22 with I think it was Dale Harding picked off a pass as UConn was driving to tie it. At the end, that's a 2-10 UConn team. It jumped out to like a 10-0 lead immediately. And we had to fight our way back. So there's a win. We won our opening September road game. 2017, we played South Florida in Tampa when there was a lightning delay. And we got absolutely destroyed by their quarterback. 2015, we went to North Carolina and Nick Allegretti played defensive tackle and we got absolutely destroyed. Remember that little Switzer kid who was returning punts? God, oh, I hated him. 2014, was it 20? We got back-to-back road games. 2014, we were at Soldier Field, right? So, no, 2014, we were at Washington. 2014 at Washington, 30-5 halfway through the second quarter, right? 30-5. The scoreboard said 30-5. Let's see here. Now we're getting a little further back. 2014 was that. 2013, we played Washington Soldier Field. 2012, went to Arizona State. Looked like we didn't even, the defense is looking over at the sideline, not knowing the signals. They're running plays while we're still looking at the sideline. They snuck the tight end out behind a formation 173 times in that game, and we never caught on. And we lost 1-6. There's our road game in 2012. 2011 was at home. 2010, 2009, 2008, 2007, We opened away from home against Missouri. Loss. So, I guess Syracuse in 07, when they were terrible. Syracuse in 07 was, we actually won big on the road. But I think that was also like a 3-9 Syracuse team. So, I know we're better now. I know we're not the team that was that team. I know. But when I predicted us beating Kansas last year when Kansas was ranked, I said, just remember what September road games are like. You've been in your bed. You've been going through this routine. You know where everything is. You know how it all works. And you open with two home games. And now you go on the road and just everything is off. Remember the Cincinnati team that came to Champaign in 2013? And they were favored by like 19.5, and we won. Beckman's second team that only went 4-8. Like, we beat Cincinnati that day only because it was early September and they were on the road. They just destroyed Purdue the weekend before at home. But then they play us and they're like, why is nothing happening? What is going on? The reason the Duke game terrifies you even more than Ohio State is because we don't win that game. Ever. Now, maybe Duke's a 2-10 team like UConn was in 2019. And then we can count on ourselves. But we go on the road and look, you know, when Penn State goes on the road early, when Ohio State goes, all these teams struggle. It's not easy to win a road game early. That road game at Nebraska last year was a big win. Because all the stuff went wrong, and we still found a way, pulled it on over and on. That's the mark of a turned-around program. But, again, I just listed South Florida and Washington and Virginia and Arizona State and North Carolina. And like, all these September road games, and we weren't even close. Like, not even close. And that's more than just like, oh, the coaches didn't have them ready or whatever. It's just 19-year-old kids, 21-year-old kids in a hotel room, not sleeping very well. They know the routine at home, but they don't know it on the road. And they got to learn how to do this stuff and learn how to stay focused and learn how to handle adversity and everything else. So, yes, I believe the Duke game should scare everyone, even if we're like favored by 9 or something. We just, you know, it's college football. Every team goes on the road and struggles in that game. Unless the opponent is terrible. And we're probably going to struggle in that game. And hopefully we pull it out. How many times do we see the barge formation this football season? I don't know. It doesn't... This team doesn't feel very bargy to me. I mean, we've got all 5 offensive linemen back. And I know they like Brandon Hansen and would love to get a 6th offensive lineman on the field. But I don't know if that means barge. I mean, we used it against South Carolina, but that was the Josh McCray package. So it would have to be a package with Caden Fagan. I don't know. Like, I haven't thought about that, but I don't know if we go to it that much. But yeah, my reaction is I don't know if we go through it that much. Does Gabe Akis finally play more snaps on the DL than the OLB? Finally there implies that this is your opinion here. I like to keep those opinions out of it of like, you know, I'm never a guy like, why doesn't the stupid coaches play him here instead of there? I'm just not that guy, okay? So I can't really answer questions that are like, why not? What they think should happen is better than what I think should happen. So it's dumb of me to even suggest that. if this question is who, like, should he, like, will he? If this question is like, you had to make a choice right now, does he play more outside or inside? My answer is whatever the NFL scouts want to see. Like, he's a versatile player. He's going to be good either spot. But there is a quotient here of, we got him back for his senior season. We promised to get him as high in the draft as we could. We will make good on that promise, and we will showcase his skills. And I know a lot of people hate that, of like, he should just play where he wants on the team. He's on the team. You don't need to showcase your skills. No. We got him back, right? He's here and not somewhere else. And I want to showcase him. So I'm good with, if he has early talks with an agent and wants to do more outside, then I'm good with him saying outside. And if he wants to put his hand in the dirt more and show what he can do in run support, I'm good with that too. So I'm fine with whatever decision is made. I don't have an opinion. Like, I don't have an opinion. Who are the top five freshmen that will not redshirt in your opinion? God, that's hard to do off the top. I'm driving here. That was terrible. Okay, so I got to do this from memory. Five freshmen. Okay, one of the running backs won't redshirt because we used Valentine a fair bit as the fourth running back this past season. This year, we have three returning running backs, so that fourth guy is going to get carries. So either Cedric Weish or John Forster is going to get carries. So let me say one of the running backs. Let me say, what are we talking about? Are we talking freshmen here or newcomers? Who are the top five freshmen that will not redshirt? Okay, freshmen not redshirting. Oh, you know what I should say here? There's a chance in July we hear that the NCAA has approved 5 years to play five. That they're tired of the waiver process. They're tired of a player from Vanderbilt saying, hey, I didn't get a chance to earn NIL at JUCO, so you shouldn't punish me for my eligibility that I spent at JUCO. And there's a chance the NCAA, to solve all that, just says, okay, everybody has 5 years, but don't come to us with any single waiver request ever. Start your clock, 5 years, you're done. You can play all 5 years. There's no red shirts anymore. There's no anything else. But it's 5 years, and then stop the insanity. We're all done. If that comes through, this is a pointless conversation because every freshman should play if they're ready. If it doesn't come through, yes, some will redshirt and some will not. So I've got one of the freshman running backs. I'm going to go Xavier Scott's brother, Zynai Scott. I think, you know, each year they use, like Juice Clark was like this. They used him in special teams and a little bit here and a little bit there, and they were getting him ready. I think Scott is that guy. I think they want Xavier's brother to not redshirt and be ready. I think Grant Bierman's going to be a special teams guy. So I would love him to redshirt and, like, get stronger. All he's lacking is strength, but linebacker we flipped from Purdue after Walters was fired. But I think Bierman would be great to play. Look, each year there's been an offensive lineman that plays and doesn't redshirt, and they play on kickoff or extra points and field goals. It happened with Hunter Whitenack. It happened with Brandon Henderson. It happened with last year with Brandon Hansen. It's just a staff that likes to take one of those guys and get them ready by playing them on extra points and field goals. So I could see maybe Griffin Russo, the offensive lineman from, he's a big kid. He's already 325, and he kind of fits the mold of that, what they did with Hansen last year. So put me down for Russo, doesn't redshirt. You know, some of the top names, I feel like they're going to need development. So I don't know if the staff would have, you know, if, again, if there are red shirts this fall, you know, some of the higher end guys, but, oh, what am I thinking? Braden Trimble. What up? Shut up, Bob. Dumb. Braden Trimble. I should have said him first. That was close. That was close. Some of you were just sitting there thinking, better say Trimble. Better say Trimble. Braden Trimble, who is great. Had he gone to any other school, he's a four-star, top 100 kind of kid. Only reason he doesn't have that kind of, because he Mount Zion, Illinois, and picked Illinois. But yes, Trimble, without question, plays this fall. Okay, there we go. That was close. Whew. Oh my gosh, almost a first Urbana exit. Okay, maybe I won't get to all the questions. Did I finish that? The freshman, this top five freshman. Did the post game. I did the tennis question. You know what? My exit is here in 3 miles, so I think I'm gonna have to cut it there. Like, there's this construction coming up, and I just don't want to be looking at my phone as we get into town. So let me just close with a general. I don't know, how do I say this? A state of the union on June, 11th, 2025. Gather my thoughts. Please hold. Also driving. Trying to check out this lane shift. Trying to figure out what's going on. The interchange, by the way, in Champaign. If you like drive down from Chicago for games. I think we're about a year away now. So it's like a 5-year project. It's going to be great when it's done. It's going to be so great. Those old ramps were terrible. But they're also, I don't know if you don't live in Champaign, you probably don't. Like, they've been redoing everything in every direction from this new 5774 interchange. And so it's basically new bridges all the way east from there at every Urbana and Champaign exit, and new on-ramps and everything else. So this stretch of the interstate has been under construction more or less since I moved here. I think they're about a year away from, I think like next spring is when it all opens, and then they'll finish the rest of everything else. And it's going to be great. Like, as far as the interstate through Champaign and Urbana, as far as 74 goes, like wide, 3 lanes in both directions, sometimes 4, new bridges everywhere, no issues with traffic anymore, wide, everything else. And then the interchange will be so much smoother with new ramps and no more tight circles, and then a 10-3-second merge onto 57 South after you get down the Cloverleaf and everything else. So, cannot wait. Almost done. State of the program. This is what we're doing. Like, I don't want to like go too hard on people being negative. I don't want to make the point of like no one has anything to get mad about over the next year. So I hesitate here because it's hard to say these words without you only hearing that. But these are the days. Okay? Like, This is it. We're not done. NIL opens a window, a portal, if you will, for the University of Illinois to take a big leap forward in the Big Ten and take a state with 13 million people and make it like the other states with 13 million people, like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan or whatever, and use your population to really build the financial strength of your program in a way that Iowa nor Purdue could ever do, nor even Wisconsin. So, yes, there are paths and there are ways, and we're pointed to the future, and we got to do this, and you know, this is our time, this is our opportunity. But I just don't want people to miss, if it's a 7-5 football season, I don't want it to be 2023 Illini basketball, where everybody's just like immediately, I mean, you don't remember this already, but there was so much fire Underwood in 2023, and it was so ridiculous. Like, it was just, okay, well, we were awesome, so now we're always going to be winning. We had the IO team, and then we had the Kofi team. We're just always going to be awesome. And that was easily the worst team to, the worst experience covering a team that I've had in the last 5 years. Because the fans immediately switched to, like, I don't really know how any of this works, and I'm kind of new at this, and so at this, I'm going to believe every story I hear about Terrence Shannon and Matthew Meyer, and rumors will rule the day, and we're just going to be a TMZ fan base believing everything anyone is putting out there, and you know, it, you remember, it was just this toxic mess. At the time, because we had been successful, and then suddenly we didn't match what we expected, right? You know, for the first time in a few years, we didn't match what we expected. And then that fall, football was kind of the same way. All these close games coming down the final minute, and we'd win the Maryland game on a last-second field goal, and we'd lose to Wisconsin when they threw a touchdown with 30 seconds left, and then, you know, just all of that. And it was one big lesson of our fan base of like you got to understand that rebuilding doesn't mean everything is great and perfect from here on out. But you do need to acknowledge that these are the days. And I got labeled an Underwood defender and like all that stuff when I was writing about it in 2023 of like, look, the majority of this fan base is way over there and you're missing it, man. Like, we are in it and you're all missing it. Because you're wrapped up in what these people are trying to make this experience to be. They're just new to this. They don't have any depth. They don't have any memories of what it was like in 2016 when, you know, we're winning 14 basketball games and the football team is extending the interim coach because we don't have an AD to hire the new coach. Like, we know bottom of the barrel. And I just, you're going to get sick of me saying, this is it, man. Like, even if we go 7-5 or we go 11-2 and make the playoff, this is it. We've just wanted to have that conversation of, is this 6-6 or is this 10 wins? That has always been the goal. The goal has been the risk of 6-6 feeling like a massive disappointment. And I've already seen so much stuff that is, like, leaning into, like, No. Go away. This is our time, man. I didn't drive from St. Louis on a Tuesday night, leaving work at 3:45 and sneaking past my boss's desk to drive 3 hours to Champaign to watch us lose to Nebraska, then drive back, get to my condo at 2:15, sleep 4 hours and get back up and go to work and write about a terrible team and a terrible game. I didn't do any of that so that when we get to this point, people are like, I don't know. Is it good enough? I don't know. I'm not sure about this. You know, whenever a team is good, it allows the people who sit on their perch and look down their magnifying glass and say, I'm not sure, I don't know. It allows them to make a lot of noise. And I just want to get this out there in June that this is it. This risk, this fear going into the Duke game, this, oh God, what if we're number 14 preseason, we only go 7-5? That has been the goal. We've always wanted to be right here. There is no, oh, we're just going to go win 10 games every year. You know, we would have, you want that? Go back to the 60s and make us Michigan or Ohio State. And then we could have that conversation. But that's not how any of this works. And I don't want to lose it. So I want you to hear as I'm driving, I'm probably a mile from my house. I want you to hear this. These are the days. Do not get distracted by people trying to make it all about, like, you know, when a team is good, all you can just sit there and pick at all the tiny little faults and say, I don't know. Is there? Are they? Oh, I don't know. It's just so easy to do that because then you can just rest and know that, you know, they're probably still going to win 7 games or whatever, and you'll be happy and you can go to the bowl game. But you can spend the whole year like, oh, I don't know. Is that pretty disappointing? I don't know. I don't know. I wouldn't do that if I was them. Oh, that's a bad decision. If I was the coach, I would have. No, man. We're not letting that leak back in. No. Nope. Uh-uh. These are the days, and we're going to enjoy it. We are. This is going to be so much fun. So much fun. Win or lose. You know, I'm a years of I've been talking about, like, the path in basketball next year being, you know, if we're a protective seed in the Midwest, we would go St. Louis, then Chicago, then Indy. The exact reverse of 2005. You hear that and you think, oh God, well, what if we're, what if it disappoints and we're only a 17? That's the point. This is where we've been doing all of this. Josh Whitman's been rebuilding these programs for 9 years for that reason, for you to have that worry. Okay? That's the point. There is no, I just want a year where I just know we're going to be Final Four, and I just know we're going to be in the football playoff. I just need to get to that point. No, doesn't exist, especially not in Illinois. What exists is that worry, and we finally have that worry. We are finally concerned that we might not meet expectations. Hallelujah. That beep is me pulling up close to the stepladder at the end of the garage. I have made it home. We have 1 hour and 28 minutes on I-74 from the road. Go, Illini.